Welcome to the New York Times Popcast. Your mirror is what I will be of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
I be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door.
So, I had not been in a movie theater for 18 plus months. I went to go see the Velvet Underground documentary, which is what we're going to be talking about today. First of all, I thought it was a wonderful film, but here's how I know that I was experiencing it the right way, especially for someone who did not grow up valorizing or idolizing the music of the Velvet Underground. In my screening at the Nighthawk Cinema, there weren't that many people. It was a late night screening, but there were two real rock guys, you know, like clearly spent all their time at like Bleecker Bob's or whatever in their 60s. And we were laughing at all the same parts. They were laughing, I was laughing, and I was like, okay, I'm getting a vibe. We're going to talk about the Velvet Underground documentary today, directed by Todd Haynes. On the show, it's a New York Times classic episode. First of all, John Pareles is here, chief pop music critic of the New York Times. JP, hello.
Hello there.
Long time since you've been on the show. Very happy to have you. And in case that wasn't enough heavy hitting for you, Tony Scott, co-chief film critic of the New York Times, is here. Tony.
Hey.
Blau.
Yeah.
Whereas, as has been said, bling blau. JP and Tony, I'm very excited to have y'all here, especially because, and this will not be a surprise to regular podcast listeners, I have very little experience with the Velvet Underground. This is not a surprise. Every time we do an episode about music from this generation, and I confess to not having been raised on it or being super knowledgeable about it, invariably, I always get one or two emails from someone who was like, how dare you host a New York Times music podcast and not be familiar with the music of fill in the blank. So if you're hearing this and you are that person and you're thinking about sending that email, what I have to say to you is this. I am simply a 12-year-old boy. I am the youngest person ever hired to be a New York Times music critic. I'm sorry. I just can't simply know all those things. Please forgive me. I have to get back to middle school. Anyway, JP, let's start here. Can you set the table a little bit about the generation from which the Velvet Underground comes? Because my main takeaway, temporally, is we're looking at a New York-centric counterculture. And the thing that is often posited as the 1960s counterculture was, in fact, far more closer to the center of the discourse. And here we have a counterculture. How wrong am I?
You're pretty right. The thing about the Velvet Underground is they're basically between doo-wop and total chaos. And the great thing about them was that they managed to unite those two completely polar opposites. But nobody bought Velvet Underground records when they came out.
Yes, the other takeaway that I had is if you are a band of limited commercial possibility and you insert yourself near a media and art center, you'll be lionized 40 years down the line. It doesn't matter if you sold any records. So let that be a lesson to any young scabrous bands out there right now. Find you a publication, find you an art scene, latch on, and get it cracking.
Although that's not quite how it went.
I know. Don't. Why are you trying to disrupt me with facts, Tony? Okay. So, Tony, you reviewed the film. You gave it a critic's pick. I genuinely thought it was a very, very well-executed film. I loved how it dropped you in the aesthetic of the time period. There's nothing kind of like backwards looking about it. It's backwards living. We're in the period. Talk a little bit about Todd Haynes, first of all, as a choice for this particular subject matter, and then Todd's approach to making the film.
Todd Haynes has made two previous movies about popular music that are both, you know, very, very interesting and unconventional and, you know, kind of stand above the sort of the run-of-the-mill music biopic or music doc. One of them is Velvet Goldmine, about the glam rock scene that kind of follows in the wake of the Velvet Underground. It's a fictional film. It's not a documentary. The other one is I'm Not There, which is a sort of exploded biography of Bob Dylan, a sort of a series of essays and fantasies about the idea of Bob Dylan. So he has a deep interest in music and also, I think, suitably unorthodox take on how you make movies about music.
Don't forget the Karen Carpenter story.
Yes, that's true. Right. An early short of his, Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story.
Made with Barbie dolls.
Made with Barbie dolls. And that actually gets to my second point, which is that he is also, as a filmmaker, steeped in and very aware of an avant-garde experimental film tradition that's very much part of where the Velvet Underground came from. One of the things that I think is really important and wonderful in this movie is that it establishes the links between their music and other arts that were happening around them in New York City in the mid and later 60s, very much including avant-garde and experimental film. So the key figure around the Velvet Underground, the person who in some ways created them, is Andy Warhol, who at the time was very interested in filmmaking. One of the main voices in the documentary is Jonas Mikas, who's sort of the godfather and gadfly of the underground film scene in New York. So all of that gives Haynes a cinematic vocabulary to draw on that complements and fleshes out what the music is doing.
Can you talk a little bit about not simply, well, I guess building on that, the aesthetic choices that Haynes is making in this film? Because one of the challenges, or I actually think low-key in this case, a gift of making a film about the Velvet Underground, is there is essentially no footage of the Velvet Underground performing.
It's a great blessing, actually, because usually what you have in a historical music documentary is lots of TV clips, you know, on Top of the Pops or American Bandstand or whatever.
I've got a secret in this
right,
case.
Right, right. Hee-haw, or, you know, what or the Ed Sullivan Show, you know, wherever musicians. And since, as you said, the Velvet Underground had no commercial profile at all. They were not part of pop music in an institutional or commercial sense pretty much at all. They weren't on TV. And there are some very kind of grainy, almost unrecognizable clips of film that was maybe shot around some of their shows, but you don't have the live performance aspect. So what Haynes does is he layers the music. There's this fair amount of audio, of performance, of live audio of them performing, and just sort of layers that under a collage of faces and street scenes and some of the musicians and interview subjects in the present and the scene that they were coming from in the past. So it has a much more open and loose and less programmed, less TV-like texture, visual texture and mood than most music documentaries do.
Okay, so in the film, I think there's that Jonathan Richman moment where he's talking about how there are these kind of almost like unplaceable sounds when he would go to Velvet shows, where he'd just be like, okay, like it's not coming from Lou, it's not coming from John, but it's coming from somewhere. And that kind of like the total is more than the sum of the parts kind of energy. Do you see any parallels between how the pastiche approach that Richman and others describe Velvet Underground music making and the visual choices that Haynes is making in this film?
That's a very good point and a good question, because one of the sort of a thesis about the Velvet's music is that it's a kind of fusion or collision of John Cale, who is a classically trained violist and very much a protege of John Cage and an avant-gardist, and Lou Reed, who is from Long Island, who loved pop music. You know, he's the sort of the doo-wop angle that John was talking about. And the two of them kind of coming together in what was a very volatile but also very productive creative partnership, along with the vocals of Nico, the German actress and model who was brought in by Warhol to be the female singer. And it creates this thing that is hard to account for, all of the weird layers and overtones and implications that the sound has. And I think what the film is trying to do is do something like that by taking the visual arts, by taking literature, by taking all of the different cross currents of the time that contributed to what the Velvet Underground was and layer them together in something that will feel larger and richer and stranger than just a narrative documentary film.
JP, in watching the film, did it recall the kind of specific productive tensions of hearing the Velvet Underground in that era?
Well, I think the great thing about the film is that it manages to convey the sense of overload that the Velvets specialized in. And you have to remember, it was the analog days. I mean, we did not have 20 split screens. We weren't barraged with information. And the Velvets experience was a multimedia experience. Warhol was projecting footage of the band performing on the band as they performed, while the audience had the spotlights to play with. It wasn't, you know, 64 track Dolby Atmos. It was a bunch of amps cranked up as loud as they could and a bunch of blinking lights. And what the film manages to convey is that in that analog era, that was the overload. And I think that it's nice that the film is so overwhelming. I mean, I wanted to freeze frame everything.
Okay, so for me, as someone only moderately familiar with the band's catalog, right? I think the thing that I was probably most frustrated by in this film, there's a lot about the setup for what the band's going to be, but there's not a lot of kind of like album for album deep dive music stuff. I know that's not the intent of the film, but I, you know, if you're going to have a documentary of this scale about a band this important, it did feel like a little bit of a hole for me and potentially for some others. I've read a bunch of reviews and writing and thinking about the film, and I think this comes up a bit. JP, do you feel like more of that would have thickened and deepened the film, or in a way, would that have been a violation of the aesthetic choices that really are what's holding the leash here?
I'm more familiar with them, so I really didn't need the primer. But one thing I liked about it was that they geeked out on the very early stuff.
The early stuff, yeah. The Lamont Young stuff.
The Ostrich by the Primitives, which is John Cale and Tony Conrad, avant-garde composers dragged to Long Island to work with Lou Reed on a non-existent dance craze song that turns into basically an early Velvet Underground's Drone.
We should play that, because that was a fun moment. Let's play The Ostrich, and we'll be back in just a second.
The other thing I liked about the geeking out is that they have that very early demo version of I'm Waiting for the Man, where he sounds like, you know, it's a Bob Dylan coffeehouse song. And you realize how much Cale transformed what was Lou Reed's basically three chord folk rock doo-wop into this wall of noise.
Do you feel like that era, and especially getting into the Lamont Young stuff, is that stuff that other films have tried to tackle or has been captured in anything like this? Or is that this kind of a first spotlight on that?
I don't think so. You know, I feel like there's a lot, I don't know about feature films, but there's a fair amount about the factory and Warhol in the early 60s. But that nexus where it's avant-garde music and avant-garde film and what Warhol was doing in pop art, I had not seen that nexus kind of established and explored so specifically. What I like about that a lot is just the sort of the how many characters show up. For example, Jackson Browne, you know,
of all people,
who wrote one of Nico's signature songs, but who was, you know, hanging around kind of at the fringes of the scene before he went off to California. And that was sort of fascinating because there's a lot in the movie about the Velvet Underground's hatred of California and yeah, the sort of like East Coast, West Coast rivalry between the sort of the proto-punks from New York and the hippies in LA.
I do want to say that was one of the moments in which the older gentleman in the screening and I like both laughed at the same time. And I was like, okay, I'm on the right team here. Like, you know what I mean?
Just how much they hate Frank Zappa.
Yeah, it's tremendous. And also, I guess it must've been Mo Tucker who describes Bill Graham kind of like whispering at them before they went on stage in San Francisco, like, I hope you bomb. You know, like, just phenomenal. Like, here's, you know, Bill Graham, basically like the promoter of like the eventual Summer of Love aesthetic is what this guy's working on. And then these folks show up from New York and dressed in all black. And he's like, this, I don't want this to work. This can't work. This goes against everything I believe in. So that was great.
I do want to say the one historical clinker is when Mary Warnoff calls the Mothers of Invention hippies. Mothers of Invention were like the West Coast cynical equivalent of Lou Reed.
They just didn't scan that way. They don't, like, from a distance, they don't scan that way.
But it was sort of, I mean, Frank Zappa, right, was notoriously hostile to the hippies and the drug culture and all of that. But it is, I think it's sort of a case of the narcissism of small differences, you know, where here's these people out here who are doing something that's a little too much like what we're trying to do.
Wait, Tony, did you just freestyle that phrase, the narcissism of small differences?
I believe Sigmund Freud freestyled it some 100 years ago. But
okay, well, I didn't read, I must have not read that Freud.
On the podcast, though.
Okay, first, yeah, I didn't read that in Social Studies 10. So, okay, I must have skipped that Freud. Shout out to Freud for nailing that and underscoring everything that ever happened on Twitter and anticipating it 100 some odd years previously. So shout out to Freud. Tony, can you talk a tiny bit about some of the choices that Haynes made, especially not really interviewing anybody looking in the rear view? You know, we're used to music documentaries as these kind of hagiographical things, right? It's a bunch of people who are influenced by the subject, both recalling their exposure to the subject and then asserting just how influential, creative, provocative, whatever it may be that they were. There is a hard cutoff here. If you were not there, you are not in this film.
This, I have to say, filled me with joy because one of several things that I have a lot of beefs with the way documentaries are kind of churned out these days. And one of my beefs is having celebrities who are not necessarily relevant to the story talk about other celebrities.
Why was Dave Grohl not in this film?
Right, exactly. Whereas the exception, but the wonderful exception, is Jonathan Richman, who was there, who was a fan.
He was there.
Who absorbed the influence most directly, you know, through,
he gets a
through
pass.
His skin as a teenager in Boston. The other wonderful absence, I think, is the likes of us, you know, scholars, historians, critics, journalists coming to sort of to weigh in and pontificate. I mean, there is a film critic in the movie. It's Amy Taubin, a wonderful film critic, but she was there. She was in Warhol's movies. She was part of the scene. And she also throws some cold water on the scene in a way in pointing out just how hostile to women and how cruel it was to women who are associated with it.
One thing I liked about the film is how surly everybody is. You know, it's not, you know, those were great times. We were so happy. They're still carrying around all these old resentments and grudges. And the Velvet Underground had a lot of hostility and antagonism in it. That's what made them so unhippie. And to just see these people still fighting those battles, it feels very documentary. It feels more real than the usual hagiography.
It sort of echoes the formal choices because you really do feel like you are in the thing. You don't feel like you're remembering the thing. You feel like you're in the thing. And to have that kind of friction still kind of be like moist on people's lips, you know, it is very powerful. JP, what struck you the most in that category? What struck you the most as far as like people are still carrying this X amount of years later?
John Cale comes across through the movie as this thoughtful guy, that great Welsh accent. He's still alive. And Mary Warnoff twists up her face and says, you know, he could be horrible. That struck me.
It was interesting to have her kind of as, I don't know if corrective is quite right, but as like a counterpoint to him, because he does end up being, I almost want to say, the historical and moral center of the film, very simply because he's still alive and can do some of the functional narration, and Lou Reed is not. But I do think some of Lou Reed, you know, Lou Reed, who's, I mean, I've never met him, but, you know, is sort of believed and known to be somewhat of a curmudgeon and a little bit difficult interpersonally, I think maybe gets softened a tiny bit just by dint of not being in the film talking to the camera in any formal way. It's almost like you can't fully grasp if he is serrated in some way, you don't totally get it. That's how it felt to me.
I sort of felt the opposite because since he wasn't there in the present to kind of be a charming, reflective older guy, in the way that Cale was. Cale, you know, the sense of his own difficulty and spikiness and stubbornness and hostility, which was very much part of what was happening in the band, that sort of, you know, softened and rationalized. And he, whereas Lou Reed, there are just some still photographs of Lou Reed and the expression on his face, and some people just telling like little fragments of anecdotes about his intransigence and his cruelty. And I mean, he just broke up the, you know, he just fired John Cale. He broke up the band, you know, but he's a sort of almost kind of ghostly, monstrous presence hovering around the edges of it, I felt like, whose voice comes in on the soundtrack in these archival recordings, you know, with the great New York accent. But he's the specter in a way, I think. He and Warhol are the specters who haunt the movie.
To that point, one of the things that really amplifies the spectral role, and it's not strictly for Lou Reed, it's really for everybody, because most people are treated this way, but they have the footage of the Warhol screen test. And very early in the film, you have, I believe it's Lou Reed's sister talking about him on one side of the screen, and then the Warhol screen test of Lou Reed on the other side, kind of impassively registering judgment, you know, implicitly, obviously. It's not a direct response, but it's sort of posited like you're hearing someone talk about him, and then he's kind of giving you this like, you f***ing talking about me? Like, that's like, why would you listen to this? It's used in that way. Can you talk a little bit about the role of the screen tests and kind of like from a film perspective, Tony, like how well known is that footage? How widely used was that footage previously? I know that there is a large deal that was struck between the film and the Warhol archives to have access to a tremendous amount of stuff.
The Warhol screen test and the Warhol cinematic canon have not been widely distributed or widely seen or widely licensed. They haven't been necessarily lost or buried, but they're not, and this is another advantage, I think, for the film, they're not familiar images. They're not like footage from Woodstock or of the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show or whatever. They're not the JFK motorcade. They haven't circulated that much. So the screen tests, which are just these black and white close-ups of generally very good-looking people, one of them was called the most beautiful women in the world. Amy Taubin was one of them, by the way. Those have a kind of uncanny, haunting, like, because they feel very present, very vivid, very real, very now, even as they also feel like they belong to an ancient civilization. And that's sort of the thing about Warhol, is that he does create these images that feel simultaneously very disposable and modern and ephemeral, and also kind of something you would find inside an Egyptian tomb.
Also, if I'm not mistaken, the screen tests, they're slowed down from real life. So it lends to the kind of slightly ghostly spectral air of them, is that they are not moving at the same speed as other things.
Right. And the people are not acting in a conventional sense. You know, Warhol was very interested in the kind of the distance or the discrepancy between the image of a person and who that person might be, or not interested in the second, interested in what the image could say, what the image could evoke or establish, or what kind of effect it could have. So it's these sort of beautiful, haunting surfaces.
Well, also simply they're silent too. So, you know, you're hearing your own thoughts. There's no dialogue, there's no action. You're just watching light and shadow on a screen. And yet they're people and they're larger than life and they're close-ups.
JP, what do you make of Warhol's involvement with the band in the sense of, it's like you say, it's not a commercially successful band in its day, but do you think that to the degree that they were known at all, is that strictly or primarily a byproduct of the Warhol Association? Is there an alternate timeline where they don't intersect with the factory, they don't intersect with Warhol, but somehow still end up planting this flag that ends up being so meaningful? Or is it something about what Warhol sees in the band and also starts to add to the band, whether it's Nico or by managing or taking him on the road with the traveling review? Is that really the thing that ends up being the foundation for what we now think of as the Velvet Underground's influence?
Well, every band has to get its foot in the door somehow. And it's clear that Warhol was the way they got their foot in the door. They credit him in the film for, you know, if Andy hadn't done the cover, we wouldn't have had the album. there's always a manager figure in every band story, and Warhol is that figure at the beginning. But also, there was the shared aesthetic of Warhol and the Velvets and his film people, and the whole idea of a pop art being a melted down multimedia thing. They were all working on the same thing, in a way. There was no indie rock internet in the 60s.
Well, and there was also no place that would where you could play. I mean, there was no radio station that could play Heroin or Sister Ray. Those were not viable pop cuts.
One of the things I found so kind of quaint, I forget exactly where in the movie this falls, but they're talking about like the issues with the record label on the first album and how it's like, it's Andy agreed to do the cover, so they stayed off our back. And the idea that like a known fine artist, even a commercial or a pop-oriented fine artist, could be the intermediary between like a difficult band and a kind of curmudgeonly record label and be like, well, they're not doing anything unless I give the say-so. Like, I'm trying to imagine if the 2021 equivalent, and I can't imagine a 2021 equivalent to that circumstance. It just felt very charming, like Andy Warhol throwing his weight around to like make sure the Velvet Underground could put out whatever record they wanted to put out. Felt very of a different time. Let's listen to a little bit of White Light, White Heat. That's the title track from the second Velvet Underground record.
I'm glad you played White Light, White Heat, because that album is such an extreme album. Lester Bangs used to go to fellow critics' houses and take their copy of White Light, White Heat off the shelf and see if it had been played a lot or if it was just there as your avant-garde credential. And if it hadn't been played a lot, you fell in his estimation.
Wait, that's a great party trick. First of all, how have I been a critic for 20 plus years and never done that to anybody? I guess now that I've announced it, nobody's going to invite me to their house. But I feel like next time I go to some other critic's house, I'm going to have to really get up in their shelves or get up in their Spotify at minimum. One strain that I felt like I came across in a couple of the pieces written about the film is that maybe it was almost not raw enough. Maybe almost not, didn't quite go all the way down some of the roads that it seemed like Lou Reed was certainly going down lyrically and possibly in his real life. It comes up a little bit in the film as far as places he would go and things, experiences that he was seeking out, but that maybe it was somehow didn't totally go there. Did the film feel to either of you like it was pulling punches or stopping before kind of going off the cliff in any places?
I don't know if it was the film or just the reluctance of people to talk about certain things. I mean, especially about, I think, the sex and drugs, you know, which is certainly mentioned. It's not that the movie pretends that songs like Heroin and Waiting for the Man don't know, you know, what they're talking about. And it talks about the queerness of a number of the main characters and about Lou Reed's bisexuality and hanging out in gay bars. I think you're right, or I kind of agree that there's a level of kind of intensity and immediacy to both, I think, the sexual and drug experiences, and also just the kind of the psychological experience of being there. It was a very extreme environment around Warhol, and a lot of people were damaged and hurt and destroyed by it. There's a reason, or there are multiple reasons, that there are not a whole lot of survivors left to talk about this story.
Can we talk just a little bit about music, JP? Because
okay.
I really lost. Well, look, I very much lost interest in the film when it kind of gets to the post-Kale period, right? Like when it's third album and forward, I think the film kind of loses interest in the band. And I also lost interest in the film for those like 10 or 15 minutes. You could tell Todd Haynes is just maybe not as interested in what happens when Doug Yule's in the band, you know, after John Cale gets kicked out. Can you talk about how the Velvet Underground changed as a band from 68 to 69 and 70 and 71?
Well, that they lost the noise, basically. And Lou Reed's old staff songwriter instincts of the crisp three-chord song came back. except they were Crisp record songs like Sweet Jane and Rock and Roll, which are great songs.
Yeah, we should listen to Sweet Jane, because that's, you know, if we want to be forgiving to that time period, that's, this is a good example. So let's listen to Sweet Jane.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand, Jackson's corset, Jane is in her vest, and me, I'm in a rock and roll band.
I want to pull out a song that is not in the movie.
Okay.
Which is the first song on Loaded, which is Who Loves the Sun. You have to play a little of this. This is a happy pop song. And I remember at my college radio station, I got the promotional single, which was an orange 45 with a sunburst pattern, which was like a novelty record that you get from a bubblegum release.
The sun, who cares that it makes plants grow, who cares what it does since you broke my heart.
So the Velvet Underground became kind of a normal rock band. They were good at it, but the friction between the avant-garde noise and the three chord song disappeared.
My question is basically like, what's the need for like just a pretty good rock band? You know, it seems like the Velvet Underground kind of solved a problem that didn't even know it was a problem in like 68 and 69. It, you know, it injected itself into a conversation and basically upended the conversation. And then moving forward from there, my sense is they didn't feel like quite as much of a interjection. And then what's the point of that? And then things are going to fade away. They're not going to become like Jimmy Buffett, you know, they're not just going to like tour incessantly off of the same three ideas. You know, it's not like that.
Also unmentioned in the movie is that Doug Yule took over the name of the band and put out another album.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Several years later, a justly forgotten album. But they kind of became, I mean, they became Lou Reed's band, really, after John Cale left and launched his solo career as a singer, songwriter, and rock star. And sort of in a way, you know, were the stepping stone so that he could become the rock star that, according to testimony in the movie, he had always wanted to be from early on.
One of the lessons of the film is how friction makes things better. How the clashing aesthetics of Cale and Reed added up to something neither of them would have thought of on their own. Once it becomes Lou Reed writing good rock songs with a good band, I am never going to say anything bad about Sweet Jane and Rock and Roll. It's a more conventional story. The foundational story of the Velvets being high art meets three chords is what we remember them for now, even though at the time it was like the most uncommercial thing you could think of.
From a film perspective, is there a straight or relatively straight line to be drawn from the avant-garde film scene in New York that's kind of captured here in the 60s, in the late 60s, and Todd Haynes and Todd Haynes' generation? Is there a direct line or relatively direct line to be drawn there?
I think so. I mean, and Todd Haynes has talked about this, about being kind of fascinated by and influenced by avant-garde film of the 60s, whether it's Jonas Mekas or Jack Smith or the Kuchar brothers. And you see it in his early films from the 80s and early 90s that he had clearly studied and was aware of experimental cinema of the 1960s. And in particular, sort of this sort of, you know, the Warhol avant-garde, but also a lot of the other stuff that was happening around it. Jack Smith is the name that comes to mind, and his 60s sort of queer experimental film, Flaming Creatures. So Todd Haynes knows that history very well and is very good at absorbing and using and repurposing the influences that he has and the movies that he likes, whether it's Douglas Sirk melodramas in Far From Heaven or this more kind of avant-garde experimental stuff from the 60s. So there is a line there for sure, but there aren't necessarily a lot of other filmmakers like Todd Haynes.
JP, you know, we often think of like music documentaries as like resuscitating lost histories or like helping artists re-entering them into the discourse, into the conversation, right?
Yep.
One thing that I feel about this film is it's not going to do that for the Velvet Underground. and I kind of like that. I like that it's like stubborn. It's a stubborn film.
It doesn't turn them into contemporary figures. But that's the beauty of it, is that they were of their time. I think a lot of the ideas that they put into their music, the idea of maximum irritation as a hook, have endured in a million ways. But nobody's saying, you know, I'm going to start a band and do that right now. One thing that Tony brought up earlier, though, is the scarcity of the images of them. And I think that's the real beauty of this film is, you know, you have the feeling you're inside a treasure trove. Billie Eilish has been on video for probably 2/3 of her waking life. And the fact that Todd Haynes is trying desperately to sync up a few frames of Lou Reed's mouth moving with the song, you know, it makes you feel like this is precious. This is fleeting. It's the opposite of a glut.
I just feel like you wouldn't necessarily look at that and be like, that's replicable. It just feels so of its moment. It is a film released in 2021 that feels extremely of 1968 and 1969.
Well, I'm not so sure of that, actually, because all of the like the grids of images, that feels very YouTube to me. You know, in the 60s, you were lucky to, you know, have your 8mm film projected on a sheet on the wall. Here, Todd Haynes can stack up, you know, a grid of whatever, 32 images on the screen all at once.
But I also think that kind of goes to something you were saying before about the absence of people talking about how much they were influenced by the Velvet Underground. Because one of the main things that has made the Velvet Underground famous and enduring since they were active is exactly how much influence they had. What you're saying about how the movie feels so kind of bounded within its own time, within that moment, I think is a way to try to get back, to sort of peel back those layers of influence and not talk about punk rock and not talk about the New York downtown scene in the 70s and not talk about Tom Verlaine or the Ramones or David Bowie or any of the many, many bands that 10 or 15 years later picked up the mantle of the Velvet Underground and claimed them as an influence. It's trying to sort of get, well, who were they when they were around? What was their moment?
Again, in the way that this film not freezes the band in its moment, but is so rigorous in its commitment to the moment that, yeah, I think, Tony, what you say is really poignant. It's like the word CBGBs is never uttered in this film. Punk is, I don't even think anybody ever says the word punk. No one says no wave. No one says anything about what the fallout of the Velvet Underground was. All the fallout was internal in the logic of this film.
Exactly. And I like that a lot because for someone like me being, you know, just a little bit older than you, I discovered them late, you know, and I discovered them as the precursors to the punk rock and new wave and post-punk that was very important to me in the late 70s and early 80s. And they were the only band from the 60s that seemed relevant to that. The Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin or Cream or the Doors were not interesting to me. But the Velvet Underground was, because they seemed to be in a direct line to the music that was in my present tense as a young music-crazed person. It was good to not have that narrative there, you know, to have that sort of taken away and say, no, you need to pay attention to this. This is what they were in their moment. And that moment has to be enough to sustain your interest. And I think that, in a way, that's a very radical move on Haynes's part, given the conventions of music documentary now. But I think it's one of the things that makes the film stand out.
He doesn't try to sell the Velvet Underground. He doesn't say, you know, these guys are important. He just assumes that you'll be interested enough to watch 2 hours of a movie about them.
And he's right. Even for me, even for a young boy like me. JP, Tony, what a pleasure and a joy. That is our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord, which is yumping from the last couple times I've been in there. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple, Google, yada, 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 yada. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. Let's go out with the OG. This is All Tomorrow's Parties.